February 23rd, 1974, Los Angeles, California. Police are summoned to the home of 41-year-old Ted Losef after his wife Wilda Losef claims that he threatened her with a gun. When police enter the residence, they find Ted's body inside his car in the garage after he has seemingly taken his own life via carbon monoxide poisoning. However, Ted's mother discovers a number of suspicious discrepancies to suggest her son did not kill himself and that Wilda may have hired someone to murder him and stage his suicide. While the investigation is eventually reopened, there is not enough evidence to charge anyone with murder, so the actual circumstances of Ted's death remain murky. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week we're going to be covering a controversial case from Unsolved Mysteries, which was ruled to be a suicide. The 1974 unexplained death of Ted Losef. As I'm sure you're well aware, Unsolved Mysteries featured their fair share of stories about victims who died under suspicious circumstances, and while the authorities believe their death was a suicide, the victims' loved ones were certain that they were murdered. The story of Ted Losef is unique in that it initially seemed pretty obvious that he took his own life, as he was found inside a running car in his garage, and a suicide note he had seemingly written was in the house. In fact, the authorities were so certain that no foul play had taken place that they never even bothered to perform an autopsy. At the time of his death, Ted seemed to be on the verge of ending a tumultuous marriage with his estranged wife, Wilda, but as the years went on, Ted's mother would uncover evidence to suggest her son was murdered, and that Wilda orchestrated the whole thing. Now, since Wilda had a pretty airtight alibi during the time Ted died, there's no way she could have killed him herself, so the prevalent theory is that she hired someone to murder Ted and stage the suicide scene. This is one of the rare suicide cases from Unsolved Mysteries in which the authorities agreed to reopen the investigation, but in the end, they lacked the evidence to conclusively prove that a murder had taken place or charge anyone with a crime. While there is definitely a compelling case to support the foul play theory here, there are certain details which don't make a lot of sense and make you wonder if suicide may have actually taken place after all, so we're going to explore both sides on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the death of Ted Losef. Our story begins in Los Angeles in 1974. Our central figure is 41-year-old Theodore Losef, who goes by the name Ted and works as an orthopedic surgeon. Ted currently lives in an upscale house in the Hancock Park neighborhood alongside his wife, Wilda Losef, whom he has been married to for over 2 years. Ted was originally born in Chicago and maintains a close relationship with his mother, Zelda Losef, who goes by the name Zell. After her husband died of cancer in 1945, Zell raised Ted and his sister as a single mother and supported the family by starting a successful business in which he sold encyclopedias door-to-door. Since his father had been a doctor, Ted decided to follow in his footsteps and managed to start his own practice. In fact, it was during a private reception to celebrate the opening of his new offices when Ted was originally introduced to Wilda, who was working as a nurse at the time, and the couple would be married a short time later. Well, things took a dark turn sometime after 8 p.m. on the evening of February the 23rd, when Wilda phoned the Los Angeles Police Department from the residence of her housekeeper, Bea Burrows. Wilda told them that earlier that afternoon, Ted had pulled out a gun at their house, and fearing for her own safety, Wilda asked Bea to drive her to her place. Police went to the Losef residence, and by the time they arrived, Wilda was there to meet them outside the house alongside Bea and a friend of Wilda's named Edward J. Wilda was concerned that her husband might still be armed, so she gave police her keys and asked them to check inside. They performed a search of the residence and were unable to find Ted anywhere, but after they returned outside, Wilda suggested they check the garage. Since it appeared to be locked from the inside, police were forced to enter through a window, and they wound up discovering Ted's body in the driver's seat of his Cadillac, slumped over the steering wheel. The vehicle's engine was running, and a hose had been attached to the tailpipe and fed in through one of the windows in order to pump carbon monoxide inside. A further search of the house would uncover what appeared to be a suicide note in Ted's bedroom. It had been written on the cardboard stiffener for a shirt collar and read, quote, "Wilda, all I ever asked for was one moment of compassion and understanding. I love you, T." End quote. Since the note appeared to be in Ted's handwriting, it seemed obvious to the police that he had elected to take his own life. As a result, no autopsy was performed, and blood was never taken from Ted's body to confirm he had actually died of carbon monoxide poisoning. No forensics were done at the house, and Ted's case was closed without any sort of investigation. After Ted's body was embalmed, his funeral took place, and he was laid to rest only 2 days after his death. A few weeks later, Ted's mother, Zell, met up with Wilda and mentioned that she had given Ted a watch as a wedding present. Since it was a family keepsake, Zell asked if she could have the watch back, but was taken by surprise when Wilda took it out and threw it at her. She then told Zell that she never cared all that much about Ted and was happy he was dead. Zell was taken aback by Wilda's reaction and later found out that Wilda never even bothered to put a headstone on Ted's grave until months after his death. It was no big secret that Ted and Wilda's marriage had been a tumultuous one filled with non-stop fighting and arguments, as Wilda frequently carried on extramarital affairs and had issues with alcohol. Zell learned that before they got married, Ted had made Wilda sign a prenuptial agreement that she would get nothing if their marriage ended in divorce. While Zell had initially accepted the suicide ruling for her son, she always felt that something was off about his death, and began to wonder if Wilda might have been responsible for what happened to him. Curiously enough, Zell said she did not even realize how many odd discrepancies there were until she had a very vivid dream about revisiting the scene of Ted's death. The dream caused her to remember that Ted's garage was always cluttered with boxes and boating equipment, which made it impossible to park a car in there, which is why Ted always parked his Cadillac outside the front of the house. Since Ted had undergone back surgery a short time before his death, Zell did not believe he would have been physically capable of moving all the boxes and items in order to drive the car inside. In addition, the driveway leading to the garage was blocked by a large pair of iron gates which had previously been damaged and were now difficult to open. The gates were closed at the time Ted's body was discovered, and given the physical difficulty involved with handling them, it seemed illogical that Ted would bother to reclose the gates if he was planning to end his own life. These discrepancies compelled Zell to search for additional evidence which could prove her son's death was not a suicide. When Zell met with the LAPD and the Los Angeles County Department Medical Examiner Coroner, they would not hand over their official reports about Ted's death because Zell was technically not considered to be next of kin. It was only after Zell hired a private investigator that he was able to obtain the police and coroner's reports 3 years after the fact, but they contained little information since the original investigation was so perfunctory. However, Zell would learn a ton of new information when she managed to track down Ted and Wilda's former housekeeper, Bea Burrows. Right from the outset, Bea had her own suspicions that Ted's death was not a suicide, so she told Zell her own version of events on the day he died. At 10 a.m. that morning, Bea says she arrived at the Losef residence to clean the place. At the time, Wilda was not there, so Ted privately informed Bea that he was planning to divorce Wilda and she would be moving out soon. At around 2 p.m., Wilda returned home and went upstairs, but shortly thereafter, Bea said she heard screaming and yelling before Ted dragged Wilda back downstairs. Before she ran out of the house, Wilda shouted that Ted had a gun, but Bea would always maintain that she never saw any gun at all. Bea told Ted that she was uncomfortable being at the house while he and Wilda were in the midst of such a heated dispute, so Ted paid her for that day's work and said she could leave. But as she was driving away, Bea encountered Wilda on the street, who waved her down to stop. Wilda told Bea she was too frightened to go back into the house, still insisting that Ted had a gun, and asked if she could stay at Bea's place until she figured out what to do. Bea agreed to the request and drove Wilda to her residence, and after they arrived, Bea phoned the police and shared Wilda's story about Ted. Wilda seemed reluctant to speak with the police herself, and since Bea told them that she did not personally see Ted's gun, they told her that nothing could be done. Bea then attempted to call the Losef residence to check on Ted, but the line was busy. Over the course of the next 5 hours, she said she attempted to call the residence at least 20 times, but kept getting a busy signal. However, when Bea called the residence shortly after 8 p.m., she finally heard the phone ringing again, but no one answered it. This compelled Bea to call the police again, and this time, Wilda finally got on the line and shared her story about having seen Ted with a gun. And of course, after the police agreed to meet them outside the Losef residence, they went inside and discovered Ted's body. While his death was immediately ruled to be a suicide, Bea still felt there were a lot of things which didn't add up. For instance, Ted's suicide note had been written on a cardboard stiffener for a shirt collar, but Bea told Zell that she frequently cleaned and ironed Ted's shirts and always hung them up on coat hangers. She never used cardboard stiffeners and did not recall ever having seen them at the residence. Bea also said that when she viewed Ted's body for the first time, she noticed he was wearing gray pants and a white dress shirt, but when she saw him earlier that afternoon, he had been wearing brown pants and a mustard-colored shirt, two items of clothing that Bea was unable to find anywhere in the house in the weeks following Ted's death. Bea previously worked at a hospital and had been responsible for cleaning up after patients who died and lost control of their bodily functions, so she found it surprising that no fecal matter or urine were found in Ted's clothing. Bea also had prior experience with deceased individuals who succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning, and said that Ted's coloration was much different than the other victims she had seen. Bea believed that someone must have cleaned up Ted's body following his death, and tried to share these concerns with the police, but they just ignored her. Bea had also recalled seeing a large stack of cash upstairs on the day of Ted's death, but it was not there when she returned to the residence that night. In addition, Bea found some empty beer cans, 4 dirty glasses, and empty cigarette packages inside the kitchen, which she found odd since Ted rarely drank or smoked. About a week after Ted's death, Bea said she noticed some unusual stains on the bedspread inside the guest room, which she believed might be vomit. When Bea showed the stains to Wilda, she was told that her dogs had vomited on the bedspread, even though the dogs had actually been in a kennel that particular week. Bea subsequently washed the bedspread, and the sections with the stains completely disintegrated. Zell also spoke to Edward J., the friend of Wilda's who had been present outside the residence when the police arrived to find Ted's body. Another odd detail about Ted's death was that a magazine had been found in his lap in the Cadillac, but he was not wearing his glasses, which would have made it difficult for him to read. According to Edward, when Ted's body was being carried out of the garage by paramedics, Wilda ran up to them with Ted's glasses and asked that they be put on his face. Edward also told Zell that the suicide note found in the bedroom had actually been written by Ted over 2 years before his death. Apparently, Ted and Wilda had gotten into such a heated argument that he scrawled out this message to her on a cardboard stiffener. For reasons unknown, Ted decided to hold on to this note for 2 years, so his killers may have pulled it out and put it on display to make his suicide look more legitimate. Zell decided to use all this information to push for a new investigation into Ted's death, and after a lengthy legal battle, she obtained a court order to exhume Ted's body in 1978. Zell hired a forensic pathologist named Dr. Irvin Root to perform an autopsy, and he found traces of vomit inside Ted's lungs. This suggested that Ted had suffered a violent vomiting spell shortly before his death, even though no traces of vomit were found on his clothing, face, or inside Ted's car when his body was discovered. Dr. Root concluded that Ted's vomiting spell likely occurred at another location, and after he died, someone else may have cleaned up his body, removed his vomit-stained clothing, and redressed him in different clothing before placing him inside the car. The autopsy also turned up signs that Ted had been involved in a struggle, and while Dr. Root could not determine his exact cause of death, he said that vomiting was not common for victims of carbon monoxide poisoning. He theorized that Ted had been the victim of cyanide poisoning and ultimately ruled that his death was a homicide. Zell hired other forensic experts, including noted forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, to review Dr. Root's conclusions, and while they did not all agree that Ted's cause of death was cyanide poisoning, they believed there were enough anomalies to indicate that suicide did not take place. These experts determined that Ted likely died sometime in the middle of the afternoon, hours before his body was discovered, and passersby had recalled seeing movement inside the house long after Ted should have died. Obviously, since Wilda had spent the entire afternoon at B's residence, she had an airtight alibi, but Zell suspected that she had hired one or two people to murder Ted inside the house after she left. Since there were no signs of forced entry, Zell theorized that Wilda had intentionally left the back door unlocked for the perpetrators. After they attacked Ted, they may have taken him into the guest room and forced cyanide or some other type of poison down his throat, causing Ted to vomit all over his clothing and the bedspread before he died. They then changed Ted's clothing and disposed of his brown pants and mustard-colored shirt before they moved items around inside the garage in order to clear a space. After opening the driveway's front gates, they drove Ted's car into the garage and closed the gates again before staging the suicide scene. It's possible that the reason B kept getting a busy signal when she attempted to call the residence that afternoon was because the assailants took the phone off the hook as a signal to Wilda that their murder for hire was in progress. When B called the house that evening and the phone started ringing again, this was because the perpetrators had put the receiver back on the hook as a signal to Wilda that the job was completed. This is why Wilda then felt compelled to call the police so that they could discover Ted's body. Zell spent years conducting her own independent investigation, in which she interviewed more than 100 potential witnesses and hired 6 private investigators, 5 attorneys, 4 forensic pathologists, and a handwriting expert, which all wound up costing her more than $100,000. On the basis of the new evidence she uncovered, the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office agreed to reopen the case and ordered a new inquest, which would take place in March of 1982, and contained sworn testimony from a number of witnesses, including B. Burroughs and Edward J. In the end, the coroner's jury concluded that Ted's death was likely a homicide, though they did not believe it was the result of cyanide poisoning, instead ruling that he died of, quote-unquote, acute carbon monoxide intoxication at the hands of another. In spite of this, when the coroner's chief of forensic medicine decided to perform his own review of the case, he believed that the findings still indicated suicide. In November of 1983, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office agreed to open their own investigation, which wound up lasting 8 months, but their biggest obstacle was that they never got the opportunity to interview Wilda, who passed away on May the 1st of that year. Wilda had since gotten remarried and moved out of California, but she succumbed to a fatal overdose of drugs and alcohol. Since Zell continued to believe that Wilda had hired others to murder Ted, she hoped that someone else could be brought to justice. She suspected that the killers may have been friends of Wilda's, since they apparently favored the brands of the empty beer cans and cigarette packages B had found in the kitchen. However, the district attorney's office failed to uncover any evidence which would have allowed them to file charges against another suspect, so there wasn't much they could do. Zell would not let her advanced age stop her from seeking answers, and in October of 1993, when she was 85 years old, she agreed to be interviewed when Unsolved Mysteries featured a segment about Ted's case in one of their episodes. Every year on the anniversary of Ted's death, Zell had memorials published for him in the Los Angeles Times, but even though she would live until the age of 101, she never did receive any conclusive answers and passed away in May of 2010. After nearly 50 years, the full truth about what actually happened to Ted Losef remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, Unsolved Mysteries covered their fair share of stories in which a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide, but their loved ones were insistent that they were murdered. But unlike many of the others, a new investigation was opened into Ted Losef's death, and a coronial inquest took place, but it's not entirely clear to me if his death has been officially reclassified. The coroner's jury concluded that Ted was likely the victim of a homicide, and even went so far as to change his death certificate. But after the coroner's chief of forensic medicine examined the evidence, he still believed Ted's death was a suicide. Unlike many of the other suspicious suicide segments presented on Unsolved Mysteries, you can't really fault the authorities that much for initially believing that Ted took his own life, because on the surface, the evidence seemed pretty cut and dried. Yes, they did make a mistake when they elected not to do an autopsy, because that might have provided conclusive answers about what happened. However, back in the mid-1970s, Los Angeles County just did not have the resources to perform an autopsy on every single deceased person they found, and since there were no obvious signs of foul play, I can understand why they never did one on Ted. While Zell Losef was left completely devastated by Ted's death, it sounds like she did reluctantly accept the suicide ruling until his wife's troubling behavior compelled her to start asking questions. Zell seemed like a very likable person, and you have to feel immense sympathy for her, as she was in her mid-60s when this happened, and had to spend the twilight years of her life fighting for justice for her son. During an interview she gave to the Los Angeles Times in 1985, Zell stated, quote, "I became a Grandma Moses in the art of murder investigation. I know the who, how, what, when, and where of my son's murder, and that is a terrible, inhuman burden to bear. I want to know, will there ever be a light at the end of this black tunnel? Will my son's murderers ever be brought to trial?" End quote. Now, Unsolved Mysteries featured quite a few cases in which people were suspected of murdering their spouses, and many of them agreed to be interviewed on camera in order to maintain their innocence. This particular segment was released a full decade after Wilda Losef passed away. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of things about this case which make Wilda look suspicious, but we technically only received Zell's side of the story, and Wilda never got the chance to defend herself and refute any of the allegations against her. Of course, if Ted was murdered, we know it would have been impossible for Wilda to have killed him herself, but Zell was certain that Wilda had hired one or more individuals to do the job for her. So even though Wilda was deceased, Zell still believed there were others out there getting away with murder. Zell shared her own step-by-step theory about how she believed Ted was murdered, and openly expressed her suspicions that the killer or killers may have been friend of Wilda's, though she never really confirmed if she had any specific individuals in mind. If she did, and the authorities looked into these people as possible suspects, they never found enough evidence which would have allowed them to make an arrest. I will concede that the section of the Unsolved Mysteries segment, where Zell describes uncovering a number of discrepancies about the suicide theory during a vivid dream, is pretty silly. I mean, it's not like Zell didn't make some valid points, but Unsolved Mysteries did sometimes have a tendency to put an unnecessary supernatural slant into their true crime stories during the 1990s, so they probably threw in this dream sequence to add a bit more spice to the story, though it didn't really need it. It's also worth noting that a lot of the key points supporting the foul play theory hinge on the story provided by the Losef's former housekeeper, Bea Burrows, who did not wish to be interviewed or disclose her identity on Unsolved Mysteries, which is why the segment simply referred to her as Mary. Bea seemed to be the one person who immediately questioned the suicide story, but no one listened to her at the time, and it was not until Zell tracked her down 3 years later that she finally had an opportunity to share her concerns. There's no reason to believe that Bea was lying about anything, as she later testified under oath at the inquest, but keep in mind that we really only have her word that certain events unfolded the way they did. According to Bea, Ted informed her that he was finally planning to divorce Wilda after what sounded like a very unhappy marriage, and when Wilda returned home later that afternoon, she got into a very heated fight with Ted before storming out of the house. Since the fight took place upstairs while Bea was downstairs, she never heard the exact contents of their argument, so I have no idea if this was the first time that Ted informed Wilda about his intention to divorce her. If you buy into the suicide theory, then the end of the marriage may have left Ted so distraught that he decided to take his own life after Wilda left, But the one detail about this story which has always struck me as incredibly odd is Ted's alleged suicide note, which was written on a cardboard stiffener. According to one of his friends, Ted had originally written a note over 2 years earlier after a bad fight with Wilda, but it's really bizarre that he would continue to hold on to it after all that time. If Ted was murdered, then the perpetrator got incredibly lucky that Ted just happened to have an old suicide note lying around which they could put on display to add credibility to their cover story. Would Wilda have known where this note was and provided the killers with instructions about how to find it? Unfortunately, the exact details of what happened when Ted originally wrote this note are very vague. Was he just contemplating suicide, or did he actually make an attempt to go through with it before he was rescued or had second thoughts? The words he wrote to Wilda, quote, "All I ever asked for was one moment of compassion and understanding," could be interpreted as him feeling suicidal, or perhaps he was just announcing his intention to end the marriage. If Ted had really been left so despondent over a fight with his wife that he considered taking his own life and held onto this note for years, he may have thought there was a possibility of him feeling suicidal somewhere down the line. That would make it easier to accept that Ted's decision to divorce Wilda might have left him depressed enough to end his life. However, in order to buy into this theory, you have to come up with a logical explanation to account for all the suspicious discrepancies surrounding Ted's death. The detail about a bunch of empty beer cans, empty glasses, and cigarette packages being found in the kitchen is another thing which baffles me. Bea was certain that these items were not there when she left the house that afternoon, but even though Ted apparently rarely drank or smoked, I could see someone who's feeling suicidal deciding to get intoxicated in order to work up the will to go through with it. I mean, the cover photo I used for this episode literally features Ted holding up a cigar, so even if smoking wasn't common practice for him, he'd obviously smoked before. If Ted was murdered, I really don't know why his killers would hang around the house drinking and smoking cigarettes. I guess the only logical explanation is that if they staged the scene in order to give off the false impression that Ted had gotten drunk before he killed himself. But if so, they may have gotten lucky that no forensic investigation was ever performed to check if any fingerprints were on those beer cans, glasses, and cigarette packages. And of course, since no autopsy or toxicology tests were done, we have no idea if Ted had any alcohol in his system at the time of his death. If this was suicide, heavy alcohol consumption might explain why Ted had traces of vomit inside his lungs. Theoretically, if Ted vomited on himself, he may have decided to clean himself up and change his clothing before he ended his life, because he didn't want to suffer the indignity of his body being found in such a messy condition. That may seem odd, but you could never really predict what's going on inside a suicidal person's mind. This could account for why Ted was found in different clothing than the brown pants and mustard-colored shirt Bea had last seen him wearing, but the one discrepancy which is hard to explain is why those clothes were never found. Even if Ted vomited all over them and threw them out, you'd think they still would have turned up somewhere inside the house. You might recall the episode I released last year about the Keith Warren case, another suspicious death which was ruled to be suicide. Keith's body had been found hanging from a tree in a noose, but what raised major red flags for his family was when Keith's mother was anonymously sent photographs of the crime scene. They showed Keith dressed in clothes which did not belong to him, and the clothing he had last been seen wearing was never found. When Keith's body was exhumed for a new autopsy, they found toxic chemicals in his system which may have caused him to vomit or defecate on himself. So if Keith was the victim of foul play and someone intentionally poisoned him, they may have cleaned up his body and dressed him in different clothing before they staged the suicide scene. The same logic does apply to Ted's case, especially when you consider that a vomit stain was discovered on a bedspread inside his guest room and Wilda tried to blame it on their dogs, even though they would have been in a kennel that week. It's interesting how the forensic pathologists who studied this case have differing opinions about Ted's exact cause of death. Dr. Irving Rooch believed he was poisoned, possibly with cyanide, whereas the coroner's jury from the inquest concluded that Ted really did die from carbon monoxide poisoning, though they did not think he did it to himself. So I guess it's possible that Ted could have been incapacitated or knocked unconscious, but was still alive when the killers placed him inside his car, fed the hose from the exhaust pipe into the vehicle, and turned on the engine. Carbon monoxide poisoning does take some time, so as stupid as this may sound, perhaps the killers waited things out by drinking some beer and smoking some cigarettes inside the kitchen before they officially confirmed that Ted was dead. But if this is what happened, how did that vomit stain wind up in the guest room? It's also very weird that Ted was found in the vehicle with a magazine on his lap, which was presumably supposed to give off the impression that he was reading while the carbon monoxide filled the garage. But Ted was not wearing his glasses at the time, even though he had been wearing glasses since he was 3 years old and could barely see or read without them. It sounds like it was very uncharacteristic for Ted to not have his glasses on, and one of Wilda's strangest actions was when she gave the glasses to the paramedics and insisted they be placed on Ted's face while his body was being wheeled out. If you believe the staged suicide theory, it's almost like Wilda panicked when she noticed that the killers had removed Ted's glasses and felt that people would find it suspicious if his body was found without them. And here's one aspect of Wilda's story which has never been satisfactorily explained. Did Ted actually pull out a gun during their argument? Even though Wilda repeatedly told people that Ted had one, Bea maintained that she never saw a gun in Ted's hands when Wilda fled the house. Of course, it's possible that Ted simply left it upstairs, but I have not read anything about Ted ever having owned a gun or one being found in the house after his death. I see no indication that it was ever conclusively proven this gun existed, and this brings up an obvious question. If Ted had a gun in his possession and was feeling suicidal, why wouldn't he just shoot himself? Of course, like I said before, you can never really know what's going on inside a suicidal person's mind, and Ted may have chosen carbon monoxide poisoning because he didn't want to leave a big mess behind by using a gun. But if what Zell is saying is true, and Ted was recovering from back surgery, it sounds like it would have been a pretty grueling physical ordeal for him to move around all the boxes and items inside the garage and open the large driveway gates in order to drive his car in there. On the surface, it definitely seems like Wilda fabricated the story about the gun in order to capture the attention of Bea and the police and add credence to her story that Ted was not in a rational state of mind prior to his death. But now that we've explored most of the suspicious discrepancies with the suicide theory, we have to look at things from the opposite perspective. If this was all an elaborate murder plot, and Zell's theory about how all the events unfolded is accurate, it would have required a lot of foresight on Wilda's part. One of the most important parts of Wilda's plan would be for Bea to provide her with an alibi during the entire time period Ted was murdered, but how could Wilda have predicted things would unfold this way? This whole chain of events was set in motion when Wilda stormed out of the house after a heated fight with Ted, and when Bea told Ted that she didn't feel comfortable being there while all this was going on, he agreed to pay Bea for her work and let her leave for the day. It was while Bea was driving away when Wilda asked if she could lay low at her house, but again, how could Wilda have known that Bea would leave at this time and agree to give her a ride? What was Wilda's alternate plan if Bea said no? Bea confirmed that Ted had told her he was planning to divorce Wilda, and since they had signed a prenuptial agreement that Wilda would get nothing in the divorce, this definitely gave her a motive. But when would Wilda have gotten the opportunity to orchestrate this murder-for-hire plot and set it in motion? When Ted and Wilda had their heated argument upstairs before Wilda left the house, we don't know if this was when Ted first informed Wilda about his intention to divorce her, or if he had already done so on a previous occasion. If Wilda had made arrangements with someone to murder Ted while she was away from the house, how did she contact them to let them know when to do this? Remember, this was back in 1974, so it's not like Wilda could just call or text someone from her cell phone, and I'm not sure if she would have been able to make any phone calls from Bea's house without her noticing. If this was a murder for hire, the only explanation is that Wilda had organized it ahead of time, and these killers were watching the house when Wilda and Bea left, which is how they knew Ted would be alone. Even so, there were an awful lot of things which had to go right for this murder plot to work, and as someone with known substance abuse issues, would Wilda have been capable of planning things out so perfectly? When you break it down, Wilda's plan comes across like one of those elaborate plots you see in the movies, where the mastermind practically has to be a psychic and accurately predict what the other characters will do in order for the whole thing to work. It's also odd that after they arrived at Bee's house, Bee called the police to let them know what was going on at the Losef residence, but they decided not to go there, since Bee could not confirm having seen Ted with a gun. Now, if Wilda had gotten on the line herself and told them about seeing the gun, this might have changed their minds, but it seems awfully risky that Wilda even allowed Bee to call the police to begin with. What if they had decided to head over to the house during the time period when these hired killers were in the midst of murdering Ted? All that being said, I do think Zell's theory about the killer taking the phone off the hook and placing it back on the receiver as a signal to Wilda that the job was completed does sound logical. After an entire afternoon of busy signals, it was only after the phone started ringing again when Wilda finally decided to speak with the police about what happened and compelled them to visit the residence. Bee reported that she kept getting busy signals for about 5 hours, and given the amount of time that cleaning up the evidence and staging the suicide scene would have required, I can believe that Ted's killers were at the house for such a lengthy amount of time. The alternate explanation is that Ted took the phone off the hook himself because he did not want to be interrupted while he contemplated what to do next, and he may have decided to hang the phone up before he went into the garage to end his own life. However, this would all depend on the exact time of Ted's death. Obviously, since no autopsy was performed until years after the fact, none of the forensic pathologists could make an accurate assessment of when exactly Ted died, but they seemed to believe that it was sometime during the afternoon or early evening, hours before his body was discovered. If true, then there's no way that Ted could have hanged up the phone himself sometime around 8 p.m. However, one other oddity which might suggest that Ted's death was a suicide was the fact that the garage appeared to be locked from the inside when his body was found. But the problem is that I'm not entirely sure how many access points this garage had. In many residences, you can enter the garage from a connecting interior door to the house, but the Unsolved Mysteries reenactments makes it look like the garage was a standalone structure which was completely separate from the house, and it shows the police entering the garage through a window. While Unsolved Mysteries often like to film the reenactments at the actual locations where these events took place, this one would have been filmed 2 decades after the fact, so I can't vouch for its accuracy. If someone drove Ted's car into the garage, placed his body in there, and locked the garage door from the inside, I have no idea how easy it would have been for them to exit. So whenever Unsolved Mysteries featured a show about a suspicious-looking suicide, I usually took them at face value and believed the family's viewpoint that it was murder, and there was no way the victim would have taken their own life. But as I've gotten older, I've learned that sometimes people will show no signs of being depressed or suicidal and take everyone by complete surprise when they go through with it. Back in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, suicide was a much more taboo subject, and you can understand why a victim's loved ones might try to deal with it by pushing forward the narrative that foul play had taken place. When I first became familiar with the Ted Losef case, I was 100% convinced he was murdered, and overall, I do still lean that way. Wilda Losef definitely had the motive, and there were enough suspicious discrepancies to suggest that she hired someone to have Ted killed, but the more I think about it, the more holes there seem to be with this theory, and I wonder how she could have pulled this off and set these series of events in motion. I don't necessarily discount the possibility that Wilda was a lousy wife, but that may not have necessarily meant that she was a murderer. But since Ted's death was instantly classified as a suicide, I'm guessing that Wilda was not formally interviewed by the authorities or looked at as a potential suspect. Had Wilda not passed away before the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office decided to reopen the investigation, they may have been able to build a case against her. Without her, they were only working under the assumption that Wilda may have hired one or more individuals to murder her husband, but even if they had some potential suspects in mind, there was just not enough evidence to file charges against them. As far as I'm concerned, there are enough bizarre details to make me lean away from Ted's death being a suicide, but unfortunately for Zell Losef, even though she lived a very long life, she never got conclusive answers about what happened to her son. Obviously, if Wilda was responsible for orchestrating a murder for hire, She never got to face justice, but if there are other accomplices out there who were involved in what happened, they may still be getting away with it after all this time. So if you happen to have any information about the death of Ted Losef, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about a famous case which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 attack on Jenny Pratt, who was hit in the back of the head with a 2x4 by the occupants of a speeding truck, a crime which left her with considerable brain damage, but the perpetrators were never caught. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, as we just released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the Aileen Conway case from Unsolved Mysteries, which was also the subject of my debut episode of The Trail Went Cold. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which could be placed over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I would also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Julie K, Florencia B, Asik F, Tracy, Catherine O, Colleen H, and Christopher P. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, I just wanted to mention that we are very close to reaching a special milestone of 500 Patreon supporters, and if we manage to reach that goal by the end of August, we will commemorate the occasion by releasing a special bonus episode on Patreon in September, which will be available to all of our supporters in tiers 1, 2, and 3. So be sure to sign up and help us reach our goal. Also, in just over 1 month, provided that it becomes safe enough to travel there, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. Also, even though we're a long time away from this event, I'm pleased to announce that I've been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held next year in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets for that event, The Trail Went Cold already has its own specialized promo code. So to get a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶